Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
You're listening to Over the Influence. I'm your host, Ariel Lori. I'll be talking to movers and shakers in the world of wellness and beyond, and people who have had their own interesting journey, whether it be physical, mental, spiritual, or professional. Thanks for joining. Let's get into it. All right. I hope everybody is having a good week so far. So I'm going to do something a little bit different this week and next. I'm actually breaking up my interview with Alexis Haynes into two parts. And I'm doing that mainly because it was a long interview. It was over an hour. And we just covered so much ground that I really want you guys to hear it, and I know that like people can kind of tune out after a certain amount of time, so I thought I would just try something different, break it up, give you guys a week to recharge after you hear the first part, and yeah, let me know if this is something you like or if you'd rather just have it all in one. Be nice. Yeah, so I just love the fact that Alexis and I are now friends. I like really, there are just some people that you totally vibe with, and she is definitely one of them, which is funny because when she had her reality show, Pretty Wild, I was in my own addiction. And so I was happy to like judge other people and how they were living their lives and point at them and anything to deflect from my own life, which was a hot mess a lot of the time. So when she had the show, I was like, okay, well, that's like pretty bad. And I don't know like how obvious it was that she and her sister were high on the show. I don't know if I just was able to recognize it because I was an addict. Like if I were to watch it again, what I would think. I don't know. I'm kind of curious, but I definitely recognized a lot of myself in her, even though we have very different backgrounds. And so it's just crazy to me that 10 years later, she is sober. I'm sober. We both are like on this mission to share our stories and share hope. And it's just crazy. It's crazy how the universe works and how people are brought together and how profoundly people can change in recovery, however they choose to do that. So we get into a lot of her backstory, and the second part is going to be more about recovery in her life today. But it's really interesting. She's so much fun to talk to and to listen to. So without further ado, Alexis Haynes. All right. Welcome, Alexis. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you for having me.
Guys, she's such a trooper. She came here, like, probably drove like 2 or 3 hours to get here with a sling on her arm. So yeah, I really appreciate it.
I'm just happy to be here. I just adore you.
Aww, so ditto. It's so cool how Instagram and social media and the universe and everything just brings people together.
Yeah, I mean, it can be really divisive or it can connect you with really awesome people. And so I'm really grateful for the cool people that I have met that I've connected with and stayed close with over the years. It's good.
And can we just talk about your bio for a second?
Okay.
Did you just change it? I just saw it. It says, what is it? Used to shoot dope.
I used to shoot up heroin. Now it's just vitamins and Botox.
I mean, that's a girl after my own heart. It's like, that's my soulmate right
there. I went on the Dopey podcast like a week ago, and I had said it on the podcast, and then I was like, that's really fucking good. Yeah. I think I'm going to stick with it. That's
like
I'm
a
writing
tagline.
A book right now. It's going to come out in September for Recovery Month, and I think it's going to be Recovering from Reality, my journey from shooting dope to shooting up, you know, vitamins or whatever. It's going to be something along those lines. It's pretty great.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that you're so vocal about, like, I mean, we've talked about this, like Botox and beauty stuff. It's like people kind of have this assumption that, like, you can't do everything. You can't be about one thing and then do this other thing, right?
Well, I just think that you can do everything.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think that there's a balance. There's certain things that I personally wouldn't do. Like, I would never get implants. Mm-hmm. That's my personal choice. Like, I weigh out the risks and benefits for everything, and then I make the decision based on, like, what my comfort level is, and that's it. And then for the most part, like, I do eat a really clean diet. And then probably, usually after I'm at a birth, I'm also a birth doula. After a birth, it's like midnight and I'm starving and I'll go to Taco Bell, and I have no fucking shame about it. So it's just like balance.
Yeah.
Everything in life is balance.
Yeah. It's that word is so overused now, but it's so true. I mean, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
In all areas of life, whether it's like diet, professionally, relationship wise, it's all balance. So, okay. So I want to go back to kind of the start, like pre-TV show days. Mm-hmm. So what was your life like? You grew up in LA, right?
Yeah. So I grew up with a mom who was an ex-model and a dad who was a director of photography. He did Friends for 8 years, The Nanny, all these big sitcoms back in the 90s, early 2000s. And so I grew up right outside of LA and, you know, just chaos. It was just chaos. Like, my parents divorced when I was 3. There was a lot of early childhood sexual abuse that began around the age of 4 or 5 years old at the hands of a family member. I kept that secret until basically into sobriety, pretty much, which happened when I was 19. So it was just pure chaos, like lots of physical abuse, sexual abuse, violence, alcoholism. I was just a kid that was constantly like dysregulated. Like, there was just, I was never in a state of, like serenity. Like, it was just always super high highs or super low lows and just really chaotic. And then, by the time I was 15, I was starting to use hard drugs, and then by the time I was 19, like, I got sober, so it was pretty fast. By the time I was 19, I was a twice convicted felon, and my entire life had fallen into, like, just it was just pieces all over the place and a total mess. So you know, my reality show, Pretty Wild, you guys got to see the tail end of the chaos, mm-hmm. of me barely hanging on. And that was kind of, you know, everything was already on fire and there was no putting out the flames, you know, and everything mm-hmm. was falling apart. And so that was kind of, yeah, that was like the end of my demise.
How did that show come to be? I think I read about it somewhere, but they approached you guys, right?
Yeah. So my sister Tess and I were doing what a lot of young drug addicts females in LA do. We were working music videos and background and like modeling. I put that in quotes because it's not really modeling. We're not tall enough to be modeled. Although these days, like, I look at like the Bella Hadids. I saw Bella at Coachella last year and I was in the bathroom next to her and I was like, you're not even that fucking tall. Like, you're just really skinny. Like, I could have done that when I was 110 pounds. Like, nowadays, like, models don't have to be 6 foot.
Yeah, it's true.
But back
especially
then,
with Instagram and...
Yeah, but, you know, now things have changed. Had only, you know, I joke about this all the time because I feel like my message is so important and... like, I'm constantly battling, like, Instagram. Like, I don't have that many followers, you guys. but I say, like, had Pretty Wild been, like, now, like, oh my God, I would have had, like, 5 million followers on Instagram right now, and I would have been just, and I would have never gotten sober, because I would have just, I mean, like, Jordan Woods is making a comeback. Like, everybody can just make a comeback now, where, like, for me, there was no, there's no comeback, which is fine, because I probably would have also been dead. But, you know, so we were just working and living that, like, clubber lifestyle. Like, just, we knew a lot of really wealthy people, and we were partying a lot. And then, yeah, we were approached when we were working on this, like, college film at UCLA by this guy, Dan Levy, who's actually coming on my podcast in a couple weeks. So Dan was working in the on this movie as well, and he's like, you guys are great, would you ever want to shoot a sizzle reel? And we had no idea what that meant. This was kind of like the beginning of, or like the peak of reality TV, right? Like, this is when everything was kind of blowing up.
Did he know that you guys were on drugs?
No. Okay. No, we were still, we were really able to hide it until a couple weeks into the show, when those, like, $10,000 checks started rolling in, and then the drug addiction just went, like, through the roof, you know? Because we would, we were smoking Oxys and taking Xanax and drinking and smoking weed, but at, like, a lower level because, you know, couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. Oxys were, like, $45 a pill.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
They're probably more now. Right?
Probably. Yeah. And it's just nuts. So we weren't able to use at the rate that we were until we started getting those, you know, big $10,000 a week checks. And then we had a $10,000 a week habit. So it, we just, there was nothing to show for the, all of the hard work, those 5 a.m. call times. Right before, so what happened was the show got picked up. It was supposed to be kind of about, we were like the hippie versions of the Kardashians. Like, my mom believed in The Secret. Speaking of which, we're right across the street from Agape, which I love. Have you ever
I've never been there. Oh, I know about it, though.
It's literally right there. Like,
really?
Walk across the street.
I've heard great things.
Amazing. So I grew up practicing Buddhism my whole life. My mom is like very, has been about manifestation, which started off with the science of mind, and she's been practicing this since she was like 12. So she's the real deal, aside from being just like up until recently a really imbalanced person. So it like wasn't really a healthy thing, but now it is. So that's good for her. But
now she's counseling, right?
Yeah, she's doing really well. Like, when I got to, when I was about 2 years sober, she really got her shit together and like just realized like, wow, I'm a mess. Mm-hmm. Like, she, you know, and that's what I refer to as like spiritual bypass. Like, when you're like just pretending you're super spiritual and you like know all of these words and all of these things. But I mean, look at the Catholic Church, like all these popes preaching, and you know, then they're like molesting and raping little boys. It's like there's always sick people who are claiming to be super spiritual. Not that my mom was a rapist. She certainly wasn't. That's a really bad analogy. But
it's
you
like
get
a facade
saying,
that you can hide
right?
behind.
Yes, it is. And so the show got picked up. And then to second day of filming, first night, we recorded with Mickey Avalon, and I was or was not out shooting heroin with them.
I forgot about him until now. When you
He's great.
That.
Are you kidding? Like an LA icon.
Yeah.
Shout out to Mickey Avalon. I hope you're doing well.
Is he sober now?
Is he alive?
I
have
know.
No idea. I hope he is. Because, yeah, like, God, what an icon. His music really got me through high school.
So rich, so pretty.
So rich, so pretty. You know, and that quote that I said, sliding down from heaven on a stripper pole, that is, like, meant for me. Oh, my God. And my 17-year-old daughter, I think I was 17 when I started recording the show, or 18-year-old, I would smack the fucking shit out of her.
Yeah, what did your mom think? I mean, did she know that you guys were using? Or was she just kind of in her own
world?
She
knew about the pot. She knew about the drinking. She probably knew that we did, like, a little cocaine on the weekends. But I don't think she really knew. Like I said, we were very good. Mm-hmm. We lived dual lives. And even when we were recording the show, it was a completely like dual dual existence because we were living what people thought were these like really glamorous lives, but we were actually living in a Best Western, driving my like little shitty Acura. And like I said, we had nothing. So, you know, it was all a facade. You know, that house wasn't really our house. Like,
really?
Yeah. Wasn't really our house. Yeah. Sorry to tell you, all you reality TV fans, it's not. Reality TV is an actual reality. And so the second day of filming, so we're out all night with Mickey Avalon. I come home at like 3 in the morning, take a Xanax, crawl into bed, and like a couple hours later, the cops are at my house.
Shit.
To arrest me. So the show took like a really dark turn.
And they had no idea that that was going to happen?
I had no idea that was going to happen. So to get into like the bling ring thing, so Nick and Rachel Lee were these kids from Calabasas. Do you listen to Not Another True Crime podcast by Betches?
No.
So good. So they just, so good. They just did a bling ring episode and it is hands down like the most, it was the closest thing that I've actually ever heard or read that really depicted like what the bling ring was and the details of the events in the case. And stuff like that. If you don't listen to that podcast, listen to that. Or at least listen to that episode. If you're at all fascinated with the bling ring, you should know this. Because they actually like, go and get case documents and all this stuff. It's really cool. So anyway, so Nick and Rachel were these kids from Calabasas that had been robbing celebrities for a long time. And my sister Tess knew Nick. And so Nick became kind of part of our party scene. He was this really fun... he was like my gay best friend, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
A best friend that I had become best friends with in like 2 weeks time because I only knew him for like a couple of months. So like he started tagging along with us and like we didn't know that he was like robbing houses at this point. And so then we had signed this contract with E in June and then like I said, my drug habit started going up. My mom actually kicked Tess and I out of the house and I went to go stay with Nick. And I had only known him. So this was at his parents' house. I'd only known him for like 3 or 4 months. Anyways, we're out partying one night at Bezo. I'm like in my like blackout, you know, like mm-hmm. I'd been drinking, taking some Xanax or whatever. He's like, we got to go drive to this house. Didn't know at the time that it was Orlando Bloom's house, but it was Orlando Bloom's house. So I guess Rachel had called him and was like, hey, you know, come here. And that's kind of how it was.
Called who?
Nick.
Okay.
So Nick, so this is kind of how it was. Like Rachel would like not stalking sound the right word, but like watch these houses and mm-hmm. stuff. And then she would be like, Nick, we're good to go. Like, you know, like I've got it figured out. And this was before like the Twitter and Instagram days. So like she was like, she needs to like join the FBI and become a detective because fuck, she was good.
It was like a stakeout.
She was good. Yeah, it was a stakeout. Yes. So she called Nick. So we go there that night. The robbery takes place and Nick and I stopped talking because I was kind of like, what the fuck? Like this is way, like I'm gnarly. Like I'll check cars, right? For like cash and like presents and like shit like that. Like drug funding, you know, like fund my drug habit. Like I was certainly no Mother Teresa. Like I would panhandle. I was like even considering stripping at one point. Like I was not a good person. But, like, actually, like, robbing houses, like, not for me. You know what I mean? Like, I would take shit from, like, Sephora. You know what I mean? Like, but who hasn't? And you know, and actually they make a joke about that on, like, Not Another True Crime podcast. They're like, but who hasn't? Like, I would do dumb stuff, like, as a young kid and, you know, steal from my parents and shit like that. But, like, I'm not, like, a mastermind. But I became the face of the bling ring because... Well, I believe it's not very sexy for just some young kids from Calabasas robbing celebrities. I mean, that story is like great, but it only gets you like, you know, mm-hmm. like a couple months in the news, maybe.
Yeah. Maybe, you had the know. Show. They had a face for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when they came to my house and arrested me, I'd actually called the cops a few times. There had been surveillance videos. Stop talking to Nick. He kept robbing houses. There's surveillance video from... Lindsay Lohan's house, and I think Audrina Patridge's, where they're like looking into the fucking camera. And I was like, oh my God, that's Nick. So I called the cops and I was like, hey, just an FYI, like, here's a tip. Like, this is Nick. This, because I'm like, this is bad. Like, you can't be stealing like millions of dollars of shit. Like, yeah, this is like a bad, you know what I mean? Like, I have like a little bit of a conscience here. And so when the cops showed up at my house, I was like on that Xanax that I had taken a couple of hours earlier. And it didn't like register, like, this is a SWAT team, not like some detectives like calling me in to like ask me questions about like what I know. Like, oh, this God, is like a fucking SWAT team at my house right now. And so it didn't really make sense. So I'm like chirping like a little bird over there, like telling them like, yeah, I was at this house one night and
no lawyer.
You know, I asked for a lawyer, but it wasn't until I was already at the station and they'd been interrogating me. I don't remember that interrogation at all because, like I said, I was like totally loaded.
Yeah. I was going to say, the Xanax probably dulled it a little bit. So you were
Yes. And at one point, you know, and have you ever seen like Making a Murder?
A couple episodes.
Okay, so yeah, it's very similar to like that Making a Murder. Like, we know you were there. Like, whose name was it? Like, you said the name of the person earlier, you know, blah, blah, blah. But like, they've said the name to me. Like, were fucking with me. And I was just like, whoa, like, what is going on right now? So thankfully, like, my attorney showed up or whatever. Ended up taking a plea deal. So fought the whole case on national television as a heroin addict at 18 years old. It was just a shit show, which was great, but also not great.
Did you at any point think the heroin was a problem? I mean, did it ever cross your mind that like something to stop, or were you just not there?
No. So I know for certain the reason why I used downers, why I used heroin, was because I had such bad trauma. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm talking like forced to perform oral sex at like 5 years old, like just the most heinous, disgusting, just like needed to shut it all off. Yeah. Like, just every single like bit of it needed to go away. And so no one was going to touch me or my heroin. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, that was the only thing that provided me with like comfort and like kept me from killing myself.
Can I ask, said you started using around 15, but what were your coping skills before that, before you found drugs to deal with all of that?
Yeah. Sugar and carbs. Mm-hmm. And then I remember sneaking warm beers out of my friend's parents' garages and mm-hmm. just, you know, whatever I could get my hands on.
Yeah. Just change how you're, change your state of being.
Yeah. So just whatever I could to escape.
Okay. So you ended up going to jail.
Yeah.
Right.
Took a plea deal. It's not a good idea to go to trial when you're on heroin. Like, just a really, really bad idea.
At that point, did people know, or was it still?
My drug dealer actually took photos of me like smoking heroin and posted them online, like sold them to Nick Ritchie and the Dirty. Do you remember the mm-hmm. Dirty? Yeah.
Is he still around?
He sold the Dirty, and we're actually friends.
Really?
Like, I actually.
Well, he kind of like, he had a family, right?
I actually
right?
really like him now. Like, for the most part, it's such a trip. It's like, how do you, like, he hated me, like, and I really hated him because he would call me out on all my shit.
But that
publicly.
Was his job, now, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's a disgusting job. Like, it's a pretty dirty, like, I wouldn't want that job. Like, I probably couldn't sleep at night, but yeah.
That was, like, the time of Perez Hilton, too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so, like, a lot of stuff. So the pictures went around, and, you know, I actually think it was both of us smoking. You know, I didn't really, like, you know, we make excuses, right? Like, mm-hmm. No, that's just weed, or... you know, whatever, but it's like clearly a Tudor and foil. Like, I don't know, like, whatever it took, man, to like keep getting loaded. But the cops, it was a combination of things. Like, the cops were playing dirty. My attorney was not the best attorney, and I was advised to take a plea deal, and I was on heroin, and I took it. And I'll say this over and over and over again, like, going to jail was the best thing that ever happened to me, saved my life. Going to jail twice was the best thing that ever happened to me, saved my life. In jail, so you would ask, like, did you ever think heroin was a problem? In jail, when I, like, went through the detox and naturally, like, sobered up, because I went and I was in solitary confinement at Lynwood for that summer. So I detoxed, and after the detox, I kind of was like, whoa, like, okay, heroin is probably a problem for me, and I should just stick to, like, weed and drinking.
Oh, you know? I did that quite a few times. Mm-hmm. It's like, I would pick whichever thing I wanted to be the problem, and then so that I could still have something, right?
Yeah, no, I definitely, even into early sobriety, I remember thinking things like, I'm not going to have a glass of champagne at my wedding? Like, how am I going to survive? You know what I mean? That was, like, my only coping skills. And so thank God I got coping skills, like, pretty early on in recovery. So, you know, so I got out, kept getting loaded, got arrested again, possession of heroin, was facing up to 6 years in prison. And the judge, mercifully sentenced me to treatment. And that's the best thing that ever happened to me.
So jail was your rock bottom, you would say?
I'd say my rock bottom actually happened, like, in rehab. I had an emotional bottom that, you know, like, where I kind of realized, like, I'm the maker of all of my own messes. Mm-hmm. And
it's hard when you have really to look hard at your own shit and realize that you're the common denominator.
Yeah, up until then, like, the ego was still really big and powerful, and I wasn't really willing to accept personal responsibility, you know, because it was always like, it was my rapist's fault, and it was my child sexual abuse, and it was my dad, and it was this, and it was that, and it takes a lot to get to the clarity and understanding of, like, hey, yeah, like, that all happened, and that's really horrible, but you're the only one that can fix this, and you have to take responsibility. So I think that going to jail obviously sucks. Like, no one wants to detox from heroin in jail. It's gnarly and disgusting. But actually, like, mentally having to crawl yourself out of addiction is just brutal.
Yeah, and it's hard when you do have those legitimate traumas and things that were done to you. I mean, like, we're taught when we get sober that to look for our part in everything, right? But there are certain things that, like, happen to us, and what's your part? You know, it's like your part often is still holding on to it and letting it affect your life.
And the ways that we then go out and abuse ourselves and other people. After, you know, that's where that, like, personal responsibility aspect comes into play. And that was hard for me to, like, really wrap my head around. It took me quite a while to take that personal responsibility.
Well, and 19 years old is such a young age to, like, have lived that much. That's like a lifetime, right? And then 19, like, when you're still, like, developing into yourself, and to have to, like, take responsibility for all that, it's just kind of unfathomable. I mean, I really admire you for doing that. Like, 19, I was just getting started. I got my first DUI at 19 and went to treatment, but I was like, I'm not stopping.
Yeah.
Like, no way.
Yeah, I think that for me, like, the dope took me down, and it took me down hard. And then thankfully, I think, because I have, even though my mom was, like, in my household was chaotic, like, I did have spiritual, like, the spiritual aspect of recovery was not difficult for me to wrap my head around, because I had grown up in an environment where that was really instilled in me, that, you know, that we are all a part of Source, you know what I mean? And it exists everywhere and in everybody, and that you can tap into that goodness and into that love whenever you want. And I just didn't know how to do it before sobriety. And so when, thankfully, I had a sponsor who, she was 20 or sober off heroin, and she was this amazing. She was this amazing, like, I would consider her like a hippie who lived in Topanga, and she was a wardrobe stylist for commercials. And she had really young energy. She was like kind of like a mama to me, but she had like really young energy, and she was very connected and grounding and just had so much knowledge. And she was just perfect for me. Like, she was just exactly like what and who I needed in my life. Mm-hmm. So
would you say the hardest part of early sobriety for you was looking at your responsibility in things? I mean, for people who are like newly sober listening to this, what were the things that you struggled with the most, and how did you get through it?
I think the hardest thing that I dealt with was staying put. Mm. You know, like, as drug addicts, we're like constantly on the run, mm-hmm. you know, like we're just like, go, 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 go. And like, next thing and next fix. And like, how can I stay distracted? And getting grounded and sitting in my discomfort and sitting in my shit really was uncomfortable. And I remember my sponsor, like, I'd freak out about the smallest things, and she'd be like, I'd call her in a meltdown, and she would say, sit where you're at for 5 minutes and then call me back and then hang up on me.
I love that.
And I'm like, what? Like, wait, what? Like, are you just like, you know, like, listen to my sob story and like help me out of this?
Yeah.
And I'd call her back. She'd be like, see, you're okay. Like, you're not going to die. But just like learning how to be okay with being uncomfortable. I've had so many uncomfortable situations in sobriety. They always lead to growth. You know, when we're in the dirt of it, and we're in the soil, and we just feel like we're forever climbing ourselves out of this hole. It's taken me a long time to realize that, A, you know, you don't have to work so hard, that like everything that you need is already here. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you just, and it's amazing because my spiritual practice now is so big. Like, when I say that, like, I can actually feel on the top of my head, like, light and energy, like, moving down through my body and like grounding me into this earth, and just feeling like really so deeply connected to the divine. We've talked about this. Mm-hmm. I'm not really religious. I'm spiritual. Like, yes. I love Jesus. Like, Jesus is the man. Like, he would say, you know, like, he was, like, he was like a spiritual law, like, rule breaker. Like, he like set the tone for like the revolution, for like the, you know, taking care of people and caring about people and equality and love and justice and all of these things that I want to live my life by. And, you know, then I also practice Buddhism and all of these, you know, very, you know, alternative thought and stuff like that. But, you know, all I'm saying is, when you're in early recovery, you don't have to worry about all of that. Just trust that, like, you have what you need right now,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that that even if you feel like you're not going to be okay, like, you will be okay. I mean, I'm just kind of coming out of, like, probably the worst depression I've ever had in my life, unmedicated. It's mm-hmm. fucking brutal. Like, it's absolutely brutal. I don't respond to antidepressants, or I have like extreme adverse reactions to them. So I've gone this last 8 years of my sobriety drug free, and it's fucking crazy.
How it's long really has that hard. Been going on?
On and off. So my depression comes in waves. I think I've always been depressed. Our brains develop differently, right? When we are, under immense amounts of trauma, especially as children, they're wired differently than someone who doesn't go through that trauma. And so I have always felt depressed. Most of the time it's manageable. But, you know, I think that there was kind of like a storm of events. Like, I wasn't really connected in my spiritual practice, and then the fires happened. We lost 5 of our treatment center houses in Malibu. We had a suicide in the family in December. a huge, you know, tax bill. Thank you, Donald Trump. Ugh. Go fuck yourself. You know, he totally fucked us this year.
The clip soundbite, by the way.
Oh, fuck. Like a huge fucking tax bill. Like, thanks, bro. And
I always bitch about that. And I think it's so painful.
Mm.
And somebody close to me in my life always reminds me, well, the alternative is not making any money.
I know.
And I'm like, yeah,
but here's the thing. Like, I don't mind. And oh, we don't have to talk about politics, but I don't mind paying 50% in taxes, which is about what we pay. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and I hate even talking about money because it's so gross. We, you know, in California, you know, if we were living in the Midwest, we'd be doing great.
Rolling in it.
but we live in California, right? And the cost of living is really high. My husband's Canadian. He has no 401k. He has no IRA. So we're, you know what I mean? Like, we have two kids. It's life is expensive. I don't mind paying taxes. I just wish that the people in the 1% above me, like, actually paid taxes. Like, mm-hmm. Like if they were paying.
Well, I don't know about that because, again, I hate talking about money too. I think it's so icky, but I would think my husband is like the 1% or the 1% mm-hmm. of the 1%, and he pays a shitload in taxes. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I just think about, like, I just read in this headline that Amazon made like X billion amount of dollars and paid like no taxes this year. And I'm like, you know what? Like, how are these? And my grandpa.
Well, also, our president doesn't pay taxes.
So there are these loopholes. So there are the good people like you and your husband who like actually pay the IRS. And then there's people who like find every loophole possible because they can and they use that loophole. So, you know, I don't know. I just, it was like a number of things that were happening all at once. And then I kind of slipped into this and I was starting the podcast and all of this stuff was going on. And then I slipped into like a pretty deep depression, like where I started having suicidal thoughts and I'm not sleeping and I can't function and I can literally feel like it's like a weight, like 100 pounds is sitting on the top of my head. And it just, it's very physical for me. You know, so I know the solution. So I dive into Reiki and meditation and yoga and healing. And like I said, I'm doing that TMS, that transcranial magnetic stimulation now, and you know,
is it helping?
Yeah, it's kind of too early to tell, but I mean, I'm here, so that's pretty great.
Yeah, you are. Okay, guys, now that I'm actually recording this ending, I feel kind of guilty about cutting the interview off there, but it just kind of felt like a good halfway point, and we'll pick it back up next week. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. Please rate, review, share, spread the word, do all the things. It really helps me to be able to keep doing this, and I really, really appreciate you guys. All right, I will talk to you next week.